Welcome to Covenant Presbyterian Church in West Des Moines, Iowa. This educational offering is part of our mission to bless our neighbors to the glory of God. We hope it blesses you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, Vietnam.
I didn't say it that loudly.
Well, that's a cold scene.
Welcome back to this is like our second to last Sunday with Always With Us. That didn't come out right. Always With Us is always. This is our second to last Sunday with the book, Always With Us. And we're going to open with a word of prayer. Jesus, our sovereign. You assure us that you are with us always, to the end of the age. You tell us that whatever we do to the least of your kin, we do it to you. Teach us to see you and serve you in the poor. Help us to know you and believe in you through transforming relationships with those in need. We pray for the sake of your love. Amen. So we are more than halfway through. Oh, it's not our second to last. It's our third to last. Yes.
Whatever.
Somebody help me with the math here. We're on chapter 5 anyway. It's more than halfway, not quite almost done. And as we have, as we've moved through the book here, Liz Theo Harris has made the case that ending poverty is possible. And perhaps more plausibly to us, she's made the case that the Bible consistently calls us to work to end poverty. And as we've read, we've also learned that our biblical interpretation can learn from the biblical interpretation of those who are poor. So those who have experienced poverty can actually teach us how to find things in the Bible that we wouldn't otherwise have found. Last week we looked at the economic circumstances of first century Roman-controlled Galilee. And Theo Harris made the case that Jesus himself belonged to this huge population of poor people. And this week, we're going to consider an approach to poverty that is, in Martin Luther King's words, more than flinging a coin to a beggar. So I will have Martin Luther King open the chapter for us, as Theo Harris does, on page 100. And he plays on the parable of the Good Samaritan who was on the road down to Jericho when he was attacked and robbed and left for dead in the ditch. And the Good Samaritan comes and takes him up and bandages his wounds and so forth. A true revolution of values will soon cause us to question the fairness and justice of many of our past and present policies. On the one hand, we are called to play the Good Samaritan on life's roadside, but that will be only an initial act. One day we must come to see that the whole Jericho Road must be transformed, so that men and women will not be constantly beaten and robbed as they make their journey on life's highway. True compassion is more than flinging a coin to a beggar. It comes to see that an edifice which produces beggars needs restructuring. That's Martin Luther King Jr. Doesn't it sound like him? And then on page 107, again, just to give you sort of a taste of how Theo Harris is talking about this as well, this Theo Harris on page 107, despite the fact that poverty was widespread in the Roman Empire, there was little recourse for those who were destitute. Some were able to receive alms or other forms of charity from wealthy patrons and benefactors, but the alms were insufficient compared to the actual needs of the poor. patronage and charity were focused on raising up the wealth and status of the benefactor rather than the recipient. We'll talk about that system here. There is a relationship between the disciples' orientation to money, charity, and the poor, and the Roman systems of charity and patronage. Jesus' response to the disciples gives us insight into his larger response to charity, patronage, and the economy as a whole. So, to give you an overview of this chapter, the chapter opens with citing a study that makes the argument that when Martin Luther King wrote his sermon about the Jericho Road and that need to transform the Jericho Road in that metaphor, that he actually also had Matthew 26 in mind, and this idea that Jesus is making a critique of the structures that create and perpetuate poverty. So when he talks about that edifice that produces beggars, he's saying that poverty comes from somewhere. And he identifies Jesus as having sort of initiated that critique. So, what do we find if we read Jesus' teachings on compassion through the lens that his intention, as in Matthew 26, is to end poverty? We can actually identify some of Jesus' critique by looking at the words in the disciples' question about this expensive oil. In Matthew 26, the disciples said, "This perfume could have been sold at a high price and the money given to the poor." So we're going to look at the words selling and money and giving as sort of they identify what the Roman Galilean economic system was about, sort of in terms of the book of Matthew and in terms of how Jesus critiques that system. So looking at the word selling, the particular word for selling that's used here also appears in Matthew 13:46 and Matthew 18:23-35. You know those stories off the top of your head, I'm sure. In Matthew 13:46, Jesus tells a parable about the kingdom of heaven being like a person who finds a pearl of great price and sells everything he has in order to go buy that pearl. So obviously the person who finds the pearl and sells everything they have must not be a wealthy merchant who's like in the business of purchasing expensive things and then selling them again later. And similarly, in Matthew 26, we don't know the woman's social or economic status. We know that she's got this fantastically expensive oil. We know that she invests that in Jesus. She actually breaks the container and pours out all of the oil on Jesus. So everything that she has is given to him. But there's one use of that same word, selling. In Matthew 18, the word selling comes up in a parable about the forgiveness of debts. And to contrast the forgiveness of debts with the practice of selling property and persons in order to pay debts. So the consequences in that parable, the consequences of that selling economy are imprisonment and slavery in the way that that selling economy produces poverty. And the kingdom, on the other hand, is about the forgiveness of those debts. So the kingdom is meant to exclude poverty that would lead to having to sell your property and ultimately yourself in order to pay debts. Theo Harris also brings in Revelation chapter 18. There's a litany in Revelation 18 talking about the expensive goods that were bought and sold in the Roman Empire, and that system would be overturned in the course of the book of Revelation. And the book of Revelation is a prophetic critique of the way the world is. It's not a foretelling of specific things that will happen in the future. And so when the book of Revelation critiques an economic system built on the buying and selling of expensive goods, it is pronouncing God's judgment on that system. The expensive goods that are bought and sold in Rome, according to that litany, include human lives. So the whole economic structure that is critiqued there, the whole economic structure depends on perpetuating poverty among the many for the sake of those few who are at the top of the pyramid. So that's the word selling, as the disciples are the ones who bring it up. Jesus is the one who sort of dismisses this idea. Giving to the poor is the next. Giving to the poor would not have been enough to alleviate the poverty of the poor. Instead, giving to the poor actually would have just reinforced the social hierarchy that kept the poor down at the bottom of the heap. So this is how the Roman patronage system was built. It was built so that you gained status by what you gave away. You gained status by giving to others such that they were dependent on you. So it looked like it was, it looked like a system that, yeah, that seems like that's a way of taking care of the poor, but what it's really there for and the interests that it actually serves are the interests of the wealthy and powerful. So you can see that at the top. You can see, we talked last week about the local Galilean king was appointed by Caesar, was sort of handpicked by Caesar, and so Caesar gave that king everything he had, which was this little dependent kingdom, which meant that this king had to be nice to Caesar, right? Had to give glory to Caesar, and had to present Caesar as this generous benefactor, this patron of this kingdom, which was great ideology, right? Like that's how you want to look if you're trying to be emperor. But you can see how that system only works if that dependent king stays dependent, right? You can't let the dependent king become as powerful, as wealthy, as whatever, as Caesar, because that is what disrupts Caesar's status in the world. So that dependency relationship translates all the way down the social hierarchy, all the way down to those who happen to have a little bit more today, giving a little bit of the more that they have to the poor who are beneath them, in order to gain a little bit of status, but it's the giver who gains the status there. So it works politically, it works ideologically, it was also sort of backed up spiritually. Charity was viewed as the religious responsibility of the rich, and in return for that, sort of to make that system possible, then the gods were understood to give the rich the extra that they had so that they could go do charity. But really what that does is it makes the gods sponsors of social inequality. So the rich have to have extra, which means the poor have to be there in order for the rich to give something to. And when the rich give a little something to the poor, then the gods are happy with them and will give them more. And then, of course, there's the material level, level of just economics in life. Wealthy people were rewarded for their generosity. They were rewarded with powerful positions. They were rewarded with greater wealth. They were also able to manipulate the system of patronage and donation to the poor so that they could actually enrich themselves by placing the poor in their debt. So, you know, there was an earthquake and your house fell down, and so I build you a house out of my wealth, but then you sort of owe me, right? And it may not be written down, but we all know you sort of owe me. And I can eventually get that, get my investment back, and then some, from you, who are too poor to have afforded it in the first place. So the debts of the poor, this is, as Theo Harris puts it, the debts of the poor became a source of wealth and income for the rich. So this jar of perfume could have been sold, selling is tied up in that economic system, and the proceeds given to the poor, and that system of giving is tied into this system of wealth and status. So instead, this woman destroys this jar of perfume, and she does that as a way of actually doing damage to that system of debt and patronage that had produced poverty in the first place. So the structures that reinforced poverty, she's actually trying to do damage to those structures by stepping out of the system, and stepping out of the system in a really dramatic way by destroying this super expensive jar of perfume. So it's a symbolic action. Jesus is criticizing this vertical system of patronage where you would sell a luxury item in order to give it, give the proceeds to the poor. Instead, he's looking for a horizontal relationship of humility and mutual need. One of the ways that he identifies that is when he says, well, this woman has done a good work. She has anointed him, and he identifies that as a good work. Now, a good work in the Roman system was one of those giving to the poor so that you make a good name for yourself, right? The good works that you do are in order to build up your status, or at least have the effect of building up your status. And instead, she does a good work that is glorifying God rather than glorifying some wealthy patron somewhere. Jesus also identifies this act that this woman performs as preparing my body for burial. Rome did not permit burial of those who were crucified, and certainly didn't permit preparation for burial of those who were crucified. If you read the end of the Passion narrative, after Jesus is dead, there's only one executee who was taken down from the cross. Jesus is the only one who's actually removed from the cross. The others are just left up there to be taken care of by vultures and what have you, but also to be left up as an example. Because that's why you execute someone in public, right? If you don't want them to be an example, you could execute them in private. But that's the whole purpose of what Rome was doing. Early Christians actually made a ministry of burying the poor. They became very early well known for being the ones who went into the places where the poor had died and taking them and preparing them and giving them a dignified burial, because no one would do that. That was a labor-intensive, expensive process that was too good for the poor, right? And so Christians, from the beginning, had identified themselves with that, with the poor. The Christian ritual of the Eucharist celebrates with divine glory the death of someone who, remember, we identified last week, is poor and ostracized. Jesus also, there's an interesting dynamic here. Jesus promises that the woman's actions will be told in her memory. But you notice that the woman doesn't get named in the story. She's remembered in the story, The story is going to be told in memory of her, but Matthew perhaps intentionally leaves her name out of the story because, again, how does the Roman system work? You do some great good work and you get to put your name on it. She does this good work for the glory of God, and it's told in memory of her, but not with her name on it. It's told as a memorialized action, that this is what faithfulness looks like. The people who are named in the story include folks like Pilate and Judas and Peter, the ones who are so bound up in this system that they can't find their way out of it. Peter does eventually, right? Judas doesn't, as the story tells us. So the disciples suggest that the ointment be sold and the money given to the poor, and so they're talking about money. Now here's what money does in the Passion narrative. There are two important financial transactions in the Passion narrative. One you probably will remember quickly, the other one might be sort of back in the closet of your Sunday school learnings. But in both of these cases, money is going to be used to uphold the status quo, because the whole Passion narrative deeply challenges the status quo, and so money tries to like run in and fill the gap. So what's the one you can remember? Judas. Sue remembers the other one. Oh, that was an of course. I thought I heard you name the other one.
No.
Hang on, we'll get to that. Okay. So Judas. Jesus is like, no, don't sell this ointment and give it to the poor. And that is Judas's cash out point. Right? That's when Judas says, I can't do this anymore. He gets up, he leaves, he goes and talks to the religious leaders and trades Jesus for 30 pieces of silver. Which suggests that Judas is still depending on that Roman patronage system, not on the kingdom of heaven, right? He's depending on the idea that we can do this by selling what we have and giving to the poor, and that's or selling what extra we have and giving to the poor. John?
To understand the context,
yeah,
was that 30 pieces of silver a token payment, or was it a lot of money? Do you know? Anybody know?
I don't know for sure. It would have been some... It was not an unreasonable amount of money. It wasn't huge. It wasn't really a pittance.
Okay.
The number comes from either Jeremiah or Zechariah. There's sort of a veiled reference to a prophetic passage in there. It is enough that when Judas feels remorse, because apparently he didn't realize that when he sold Jesus to the religious leaders, that the religious leaders were going to crucify him. They didn't get to. They talked Rome into it. But when he realized that this was not just, I don't know what he thought was going to happen, but it didn't. Instead, this other thing started happening, and Judas goes, and he wants a refund. So he goes, gives the money back to the temple, but then the religious leaders say, we can't keep this in the temple because it's blood money, right? That's actually their phrase. And so they take that money and they buy the potter's field. That part's out of Jeremiah. The 30 pieces is from Zechariah. They go and buy the potter's field as a grave for the poor. So it's enough to buy a little piece of real estate, not maybe a very big piece of real estate, and probably not in a very desirable location, because that's where you bury the poor people. Now, why do you need a graveyard for poor people?
What else do you do with them?
What else do you do with them, right? Like, poor people die, and they die fairly frequently. Like,
almost every time.
Almost every time.
Again and again and again.
And there's a bunch of them. And it's too expensive to bury them right, right? So so the poor people need to be buried in this field that the religious leaders go and buy with that blood money. So that's what money does in this story. Money just props up that whole system of patronage and, you know, giving little dribs and drabs to the poor. But not so much that they don't die all the time, right? Now, yes, people die at a rate of roughly 100%. But poor people die earlier than non-poor people, as a rule. That's still very much the case. Now, there's a second economic transaction in the Passion narrative. This one's unique to Matthew's telling. So after Jesus is buried, the religious leaders are like, hey, Herod or Pilate, I can't remember which political leader they talk to, but they're like, hey, this guy's disciples are going to come get him out of here and pretend that he was resurrected. And so they glue the tomb shut and they post a guard. And then the guard gets knocked out by the angel. Then the stone is rolled away, and Jesus gets up and leaves. If you didn't know that part of the story, I should have said, spoiler alert. And then the guards are like, this is a problem for us. But the religious leaders say, all right, we will take care of, like, answering for you to your military superiors. Here's some money. If anybody asks, Jesus' disciples came and took him out of the tomb. So they pay off the guards in order to spread the story that Jesus' disciples came and took him out of the tomb, not that an angel came and rolled away the stone and Jesus got up and walked out, which is what happened. That's Matthew 28, beginning of the chapter, for those of you who need to find that. But what does that, I mean, what does that sort of point to in terms of this same critique? The resurrection is a problem, right? The resurrection is a problem for almost everybody. And in this case, the resurrection is a problem for the claim that those Roman power relationships have the final word, right? The crucifixion is the Roman power relationship trying to have the final word. And the resurrection is God saying, that's not going to work. And so, again, money rushes in to try to fill the gap. That's what money does in this story. So, so when Jesus identifies, no, don't sell this thing and give it and buy into this same system and have, you know, still be tied all up in money, Jesus is saying there's something else going on here, something that steps outside of this Roman patronage economy. Content questions on that as I summarized Theo Harris. Okay. Whether you buy her argument or not, don't buy, right? That's in that economy, right? Whether you find her argument compelling or not, you at least know what happened there. So part of the idea in setting up this critique of the Roman economic patronage system, part of the idea is that debt and poverty are self-reinforcing. Once you fall into debt, you have to fall deeper into debt. Once you become poor, you become poorer. So that these are vicious cycles in this system. How does that pattern continue today? That pattern of, I'm in debt, so now I'm in more debt. I'm poor, so now I'm poorer.
You mentioned payday lenders last week.
Yeah. Payday lenders are sort of they're like the quintessential example, right? And for people a notch higher than payday lenders on the economic scale, I mean payday lending clients. So payday lenders, between fees and actual interest charges and then late fees and whatever, payday lenders charge something in the neighborhood of like 300% interest. if you compiled all of the fees as interest. What's slightly less expensive than a payday loan?
Credit cards,
yeah. And credit cards are 19-20% typically.
I've got a 28% one.
28 sometimes.
But I always pay it off.
So. Right, so there's a way to deal with credit cards that treats them as essentially a time-delayed debit card rather than a credit card. So do that, pay your credit cards off, don't carry a balance. And there are, if you get your credit card from the bank, sometimes the rate will go down lower, right? Because you've got a bunch of money already there, and then there's the credit card, and so you're only paying, 8 or 9% sometimes, depending on the card. John?
I'll jump up to the whole credit-based economy where I won't blame advertising or any one thing, but we are all encouraged to get stuff to get stuff now.
Right. Get stuff now. Yeah. And there's a whole layer of the economic model of the economy that is about get stuff now, and we'll make the money on the financing, right? So you get car dealerships that make their money, they can sell below invoice because why? I'm sure there's also a scam on the invoice. There's that piece too. But they can also make their margin where?
Financing.
On the financing, right? So why are houses so expensive? Financing. Because of mortgages, right? Because you only have to pay the fraction of 30-year loan that you actually live in the house, right? And so if we looked back at sort of the time when mortgages came into being as something that the average person could get their hands on, the cost of housing goes up. Why is college so expensive?
Buy now, pay later.
You can buy them on credit. And there's other market forces that go along with that, but sort of all of these pieces allow for buy now, pay more later.
Just as it comes to mind that when I bought my most recent car, the dealer, who was not some street corner cash only outfit, said they would knock $1,000 off the net price if I financed with who they told me to. And
yeah.
I had to make at least 3 payments to them, and then I could pay it off if I wanted to.
Right. So this lending economy that we're in now, we by and large find ways to skirt that, right? I'm talking in the room right at the moment. We by and large find ways to skirt that. So your credit card with 28% interest.
But I pay
Have you ever paid interest on that card?
1 month out of a year, once in a while.
Yeah.
It happens.
Like every so occasionally you'll pay that rate. But you're in a position where I don't care what you buy on the card, right? But you're in a position where you're able to, for the most part, pay that card off every month, which means you're not carrying a balance forward. And if you couldn't afford to pay that card off every month, and the things you were buying are necessary for participating in our economic life together, and you're paying 28% interest on something that you have to carry a balance on, how long can you do that?
As long as it takes.
As long as it takes, right?
It tells you on the bill
right.
how long it'll take you to pay the $25,
right.
How long it will take before you pay this.
Right, right. And that's like, and you may never actually get it done because you'll add more to the balance, yeah.
Most of us in this room grew up in an era where we had the unspoken expectation that we and America would always get richer, and if we charge something, that's okay, because we'd be making more money next month or next year. Mm-hmm. And that is no longer the experience of our kids, and that's a revolution to me.
Yeah, so the we are right now at a place where baby boomers particularly are looking at their kids and saying, they may not end up as wealthy as we ended up. Mm-hmm. And so I just want to name that as a piece of it's a piece of the underlying problem with this economic model. I want to grab the other piece here as well of the Roman patronage system that supports the benefactor, right? That the purpose of giving money away is to honor the benefactor, right? That certainly never happens these days, right? So what are some ways that being a major patron pays off today?
Politics.
Politics, yeah. So,
Prestige.
So, if I have my name on a building, it's either because I own the building or because I gave the institution the money that they needed to pay for the building, right? Either way, I get to have my name on it. Like, you get to know my name because I'm a major important benefactor. Then there's the political layer of this that if I pay for your campaign, with or without my name on it, I've also got some power, right? We talk about, the accusation is so-and-so is in the pocket of this interest. Right. And I'm not going to name any of them in particular because this gets thrown from both sides because we all know it's a problem, right? So it doesn't even matter what your politics are, we know it's a problem. And this woman with the ointment, she chooses to not follow that pattern, right? She chooses not to follow the pattern of, well, we give money to the poor just enough so that we can have status and the poor are still there next time so that we can give them more. And instead, she is choosing to demonstrate in favor not of charity, but of justice. She's trying to unsettle the system that produces poverty that way. Where have you seen people acting in the interest of that long-term justice rather than or in addition to that short-term charity?
Most religious charities.
Okay. And in what way do most religious charities work for that long-term justice rather than the short-term charity?
In theory, if I give $100 to Hope Ministries mm-hmm. or Presbyterian Disaster Assistance, it helps somebody get a lift out of the hole.
Uh-huh.
In theory. Now, of course, that doesn't always work, but that's what most of us hope happens.
Right, and I'll set Presbyterian Disaster Assistance off to the side because that really is like direct assistance to people who are in a bad place. Now, that may be a long-term fix because sometimes you need to fix a short-term problem in order to be able to move on long-term. But Hope Ministries is a good example, right? So these sort of longer-term partnerships with people who are either re-entering out of incarceration or are working on kind of rebuilding their lives after they've been really really horribly out of the economic system. So how do we walk with people to rebuild that? Now, Hope Ministries also has a direct assistance component, but it's built in with this longer term thing. Yeah. Now, I want to sort of hold that idea that we've got this long-term imperative to do justice and to end poverty, right? So I want to hold that alongside the idea that we have hung on to, like it's the only thing we've got, that we can't actually end poverty, that we don't have a lever big enough to end poverty, or that there are forces that will just continue to sort of spread out that economic distribution. Let me grant that for the sake of argument here, that we can't end poverty. What do we do as good, thoughtful, realistic Christians who hear those commands where Jesus points to the injustice of a system that produces poverty and says, go fix that? What do we do with the command to end poverty in a reality in which we can't end poverty?
I just think that if I give $100 to all ministries again, that I'm doing the best I can for some of them.
Mm-hmm.
I may not be able to achieve the whole goal, mm-hmm. but I can help some.
So we can't do everything, but we can
do something.
Do something. And in the case of, say, a Gifts to Hope Ministries, we're choosing to do something that has that long-term process, not simply a short-term sort of emergency
system. At least that's how I rationalize it.
Or at least that's how we rationalize it. Yeah. Does anybody else sort of navigate that tension in a different way?
There are schools of thought, I don't want to use the word denominations, who figure that proselytizing or evangelizing, which is not necessarily directly a cost,
mm-hmm.
tries to lift all boats.
Uh-huh. Yeah, so there are schools of thought that say that if we convert people religiously to participation in our religious way of being, that will make their lives better in some material sense as well. What's the assumption underneath that?
I like to go first then come back.
What's the assumption underneath if you became a Christian, then that would have also, like, even if it's just a side effect, that would have the effect of lifting you up out of poverty? What are a couple of assumptions that could be underneath that?
Well, that they will turn around and give what they have to the poor.
Okay, so there's an assumption perhaps that once they're there, then they will perpetuate the process of lifting others up out of poverty. What's the assumption underneath the if-then? The if you become a Christian, then you won't be poor anymore.
Prosperity is part of God's plan.
Prosperity is part of God's plan.
Some
okay.
Thinking.
Yeah. And so why is that person poor to begin with?
Maybe lack of understanding of Christianity. Maybe it's in some way their own fault. You can help them realize the error of their ways.
Yeah. So they're poor because they're making bad choices, or they're poor because God is mad at them for not believing in Jesus, right?
I think you can see some of that and less of the Christian ones aside in government, in social, Medicare, and that's the wrong one. I want ones that help the poor at this point where they get benefits.
Mm-hmm.
And then they recently, from my understanding, have kind of said, well, it's your own fault, and we're perpetuating that. In order to not perpetuate that, now you need to find a part-time job.
So there's a piece of that assumption in placing a work requirement on those safety net programs. On the other hand, those safety net programs are there why? The safety net programs are there to catch people who are already at the bottom, right? I'd say there's actually maybe more, there's probably more of that assumption, say, in like a Pell Grant kind of program, where the reason poverty is there is because people didn't go to college. Now, structurally, there's a huge correlation between between education and economic status. But it's not absolute, right? You can go to college and still come out really poor. You can not go to college and come out really wealthy, with or without having started really wealthy, although starting out wealthy is a great way to continue being wealthy, for the most part. But the sort of the logic behind, say, a Pell Grant is that if people, you know, if people come up in education, then they'll then that's like this long-term fix to poverty. And you can, I mean, you can do that either as there's a structural problem here, this is an individualized structural solution, or you could say the problem here is that poor people don't know enough, let's learn them some stuff.
For a Pell Grant or other forms of charity, some people will say, we should do this mitzvah because it's what God calls on us to do. Mm-hmm. For other people, they'll have an entirely different analysis, as you were saying. Mm-hmm. And I think of other religions in Judaism, as far as I understand it, giving is just a mitzvah. You're not, mm-hmm. it isn't for your own glory, at least in theory, although
right.
you've said that isn't universally true. But in Buddhism, for example, the universe calls upon you to support the poor, and there's no payback that I know of.
Right, at least not in this life, right?
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So this gets into really murky territory around motivations and assumptions and what are good long-term effects, right? So this is complicated stuff that may not ultimately end up ending poverty, right? If we operate with the assumption there are these other structural forces that continue to, I keep spreading the distribution like the distribution spreads much that way. The distribution mostly spreads that way from that way, depending on how your graph is oriented, right? But so the system has a tendency to push people down because it's easier to go down than it is up. And so even to the extent that it's easier to go down than it is up, we still have a particular responsibility as Christians to work for these structural changes, even alongside the sort of the short-term charitable responses. All right, next week we're going to look at Jesus as a social movement leader and look at a little bit more about in real world, I'll say the word political, I don't mean partisan, but real world political implications of this anointing, real world implications of Jesus' ministry and the way that he calls us to live differently in the world. So that'll be chapter 6 for next week. We'll see you then.
Thank you for listening. Learn more about our mission at wdmcovenant.org.